Well, you know, they say that... is this okay? Am I getting a bit of feedback? They say that no good deed goes unpunished. And it seems that in return for standing in at Oxshott today, I've ended up preaching on the hardest topic in Christianity. So I'm going to have a little word with Patrick. And we're continuing the series of Summer of Psalms, and we come to Psalm 91. And there we find the psalmist singing that those who abide in the shadow of the Almighty, those who make the Lord their refuge, will not have evil befall them, and no scourge will come near their tent. And you will, of course, have recognized verses 11 and 12. He will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up so that you will not dash your foot against a stone. For these are the words that Satan uses to test Jesus in the wilderness in Matthew 4. It is a beautiful psalm. But the briefest reflection must lead one to say that it simply isn't true. It's simply not the case that good people who obey God and who abide in him are protected from harm. Bad things do happen to good, God-fearing people all the time. And indeed, there are many other psalms in which the psalmist recognizes this fact, begs God for rescue, and demands that the Lord provides justice. So you can see now what I mean about this being the hardest topic in Christianity. It's the question that haunts us when our fervent prayers for healing go unanswered, or when we're moved by the suffering of the innocent. If God is love and justice, why does he allow the innocent to suffer? Now, not only is the worldview set out in Psalm 91 apparently at odds with reality, but it can also lead people to blame themselves wrongly for their misfortunes. People in pain may think that God cannot possibly be visiting such suffering on them randomly, because that would mean that God is unjust. And so they conclude their suffering must be due to some sin they have committed or some failing in their religious observances. Certainly this was the view in biblical times. And we see it expressed in the rebukes of Job's friends, who tried very hard to convince him that there can be no other explanation for his misfortunes. They must be due to his own sin, although Job knows that he is innocent. And sadly, this way of thinking persists even now. A woman I know suffered the unimaginable pain of losing her 17-year-old son to cancer. And after his death, a member of her church came to her and said that she knew why their prayers for him had not been answered. It was because they had prayed the wrong prayers. Now, of course, it's true that our behavior can bring suffering upon us. If you drink too much, you get a hangover. But when it comes to misfortune, I think we must be clear that sin and suffering are not connected in this way in our world. And Jesus himself says so. In Luke, he talks about the Galileans who were murdered by Pilate and the 18 people who were killed when the Tower of Siloam fell on them. And he says outright that their sufferings were not due to their sin. And in John, Jesus says that a man's blindness was not due to his sin or his parents' sin. Both of these gospel stories raise difficulties of their own, which we don't have time to go into, but the main point is that Jesus himself dismisses the idea that God will visit suffering on us simply because we have failed to be good. But that doesn't help us answer the question, why do bad things happen to good people? Well, one answer to that question is given by Rabbi Harold Kushner in his multi-million-selling book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And his answer is that we must accept that God has limitations. He writes, But if we can bring ourselves to acknowledge that there are some things that God does not control, many good things become possible. We will be able to turn to God for things He can do to help us, instead of holding on to unrealistic expectations of Him, which will never come about. This is a pragmatic approach that I believe has given comfort to many, but which seems wholly inadequate and deeply unbiblical to many others, myself included. And I believe that this is not a valid solution for followers of Jesus. A better answer is God's answer to Job in response to Job's cry of why. God does not say, "I'm so sorry, I would like to help you, but I can't." Instead, his response is to give Job a vision of God's power, which instead of diminishing Job's idea of God, simply leaves him speechless. Again, that is an answer. In the face of suffering, one answer is to keep your eyes firmly on God. But that answer, too, is not complete. So what then is my answer? I don't have one. I don't have one, but I do have something else. I have something that Job and his friends did not have, and something which Rabbi Kushner does not have. I, or rather we, have Jesus. In Jesus, we discover a God who, for reasons we cannot fully know, has allowed the suffering of the innocent in his creation, but who is not a cold and indifferent God, cold and indifferent to that suffering, or inadequate to the task of dealing with it. In Jesus, instead, we find a God who suffers with his creation, and who, through that suffering, is bringing creation to salvation. In Jesus, we find a God whose love is not remote or helpless, but active. He's not a God who simply reveals his power as he did to Job. He is a God who is prepared to enter his creation and suffer and die in order to end suffering and death. This is of deep comfort, yes. And yet, after reading the latest horror story of child abuse, even this may feel inadequate. There are times when, despite knowing that God is creating something perfect through the suffering of his son, we ask, couldn't he have done it in some other way without having to have the little children suffer? And in those dark moments, there is another answer, or perhaps it's simply a comfort. And that is that Jesus trusted in what God was doing. He trusted it so much that he obeyed God unto his death on the cross. And if Jesus had such faith in the goodness and rightness of the Father's plan, then so will I. And one day we will be face to face with God, and perhaps then we will see and accept that suffering was necessary or unavoidable in order to bring things to their fulfillment. I'm drawing to a close now and coming back to the psalm. In the face of the reality that good people do suffer harm, how best should we understand this psalm? Well, a good place to start is to look at the response of Jesus himself to Satan in Matthew, where he quotes Deuteronomy, "Again, it is written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." In other words, to expect or demand of God on the basis of Psalm 91 that he owes us his help because we've been good is not a good basis for a life of faith. Instead of playing and experimenting with God's rescuing power, we should rather quietly trust him in the life of every day. And in the meantime, we can turn to Psalm 91 as a vision of how things should be, a vision that we can rejoice in, knowing that it is and will be the final truth through the cross of Christ. Amen.